Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. In late 2012, struggling American journalist Theo Podnos slipped into Syria to report on that country's civil war, hoping to make a name for himself. Shortly afterward, he was kidnapped by Al-Qaeda captors who, because he spoke fluent Arabic, thought he worked for the CIA. For months on end, he was brutally tortured, eventually becoming a confidant of one Al-Qaeda top commander before he was finally released.
It was as if young men suddenly got a clubhouse in the neighborhood. And there's TV in the clubhouse, and there's tons of food, keys to Toyota Hilux and guns. And, you know, they had important prisoners to take care of and secrets and people to beat the shit out of and torture. I mean, the guys in Jabhat al-Nusra are having a great time, except that they get killed every once in a while.
That's Theo Podnos speaking in Theo Who Lived. That's a personal account of his physical and emotional journey at the hands of his Al-Qaeda captors and his transformation once he was let go to forgiveness, reconciliation, and an advocacy for the people in Syria. It's been a long road back for Theo Podnos since the day his trusted sources turned on him. Theo spoke with John Hockenberry earlier this week.
First of all, Theo, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
What was it that said you needed to really experienced this firsthand in Syria?
I had been living in Syria before the war. I was there at the outbreak of the war. And I knew at the time that other journalists, once the violence really got going, journalists from outside were trying to get in there and the regime was refusing them visas. Meanwhile, I was there and I was writing and reporting and I thought, gee, because I speak the language, because I know some of the important religious dynamics that I felt were underlying the conflict. I thought, gee, I have an unusual perspective and I can write. And I did write in the beginning. And I found that, just being on the ground there and writing, I said, gee, I have an unusual capacity, like a point of view, really, at this point, and I need to take advantage of it, write more and more. And if I do, my journalism career will flourish and prosper.
You also began then in this whole environment of the Arab Spring. I mean, that was really the sort of the tail end of that kind of context.
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking about early 2011, the very beginning of the conflict. I was in Damascus. I was writing a little bit for the New Republic. And then when the violence really picked up, I left. In 2012, I went back. Now, that's when the Arab Spring was almost petering out and the Islamist groups were gathering more and more strength and moral authority on the ground. And I didn't really know this, and I got myself in trouble right away.
How did knowing Arabic prove to be your undoing in a certain respect?
Good question. Because when I was talking to my kidnappers and did not know they were my kidnappers, they said to one another, gee, he speaks nice Arabic. Must be well-trained, must be a CIA agent. They made this conclusion, you know, without telling me, of course. And then when I escaped from these kidnappers and I went to the Islamic court, the judge goes, very good Arabic. Where'd you learn? And I was trying to tell them all. I taught myself in the schools, which I paid for myself. They didn't believe it. No, you've been very well-trained. For 2 years, I heard this refrain from them. Oh, he's been very, very well trained. And so...
Did you ever get accused of being an Israeli?
No, not an Israeli, no.
Because I remember when I was in Israel, people who knew Arabic too well who were journalists were viewed as Israeli security.
You know, Syria is so far from Israel, like psychologically speaking, obviously physically it's next door. But no, they're not aware of the fact that there are Israeli Jews that speak good Arabic.
Although just the idea that, you know, speaking the language would be your undoing is such a sense of just how much distrust and suspicion floats through that.
That's quite right. I also tried to convince them that I had written about the rebels and the rebellion in general, the insurrection or revolution, whatever you want to call it. I'd written about this in a sympathetic way, like I was very much on the side of these men that I felt were pursuing justice and doing the right thing. And I told them, like, I'm on your side. Don't do this to me. And they didn't believe me.
What insight did you believe you had regarding the religious dimensions of the conflict in Syria?
I mean, I had written about what it is that the Alawites, it's a secret religion, by the way, the family of Bashar al-Assad and his supporters, his most ardent supporters come from an area of Syria along the northern coast, north of Lebanon. And their religion is slightly different from normal mainstream Islam. Not that different, but it's a little bit different. And I had written about the ways in which it's different and the identity of this Alawite clan, what sorts of things they believe in. And I had written and I had lived, you know, and studied Sunni Islam in Yemen. So I knew about both sides and felt I could add some sense of the religious dimensions of this conflict, which, by the way, were becoming more and more important.
Why didn't the people who were your captors think that that was a worthy goal or believe that that's what you were trying to accomplish?
They don't believe a word, or they simply refused to speak to me for the first like year and a half. It was put your face to the wall, shut up, and then whack. I just could not I couldn't say a word to them. You know, it was all abuse, 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 abuse.
What was it like when you realized that you were in custody, that you did not have any freedom? Journalism was over.
What was that? It was like dropping through the rabbit hole. I was through the looking glass. I was into deep Al-Qaeda land, and I was just terrified. I thought they were about to kill me. So I was in like a state of suspended numbness, strangeness. I thought these are the last moments of my life. And, you know, and I was trying to just take note of what the earth was like before I left it. That's what it was like right away, you know. And it remained that way for a long time because their specialty is making you feel that you're about to meet God and they want to prepare you for your encounter with Allah. So I was preparing myself.
What's it like to be in that state for so long? I mean, is it fear? Is it demoralization?
Yes.
I mean, oh my goodness.
It was fear. And I mean, I tried to communicate with my family because it was like where I'm going, you know, death, the other side, I might not be able to have such communication like I have here with you, Mom. So I'll talk to you now as I can. I didn't have any books. I didn't have anything to like look at in my cell, no pictures, like barely a window. So I just conjured conversations in my brain, and you know these. I was lost. Sometimes I didn't know if it was day or night, and I was always every time the door opened, my whole body shook, because sometimes they were bringing me food, but sometimes they're coming in with the torture stuff. So it's a horrifying situation. By the way, I'm fine now. I mean, I survived. I can play tennis. I run around. I'm happy. But what they did to me is going on every day across Syria, and it's in the interest of humanity to stop it. It's not just the rebels, the regime. It's everybody doing a lot of horrible stuff to everybody else. And I think the U.S. government is not – we have no authority, no influence, no capacity to affect anything that's occurring on the ground. And to me, it's unfortunate misreading of the situation. We could, but we don't.
I understand that you don't want to portray yourself as being treated worse than the individuals who are in the middle of Aleppo, for instance, and that makes sense to me. But just personally, in that situation, knowing that you were in the custody of Al-Qaeda, did you feel as though you brought this on yourself, you were trying to—
I did bring it on myself. I submitted myself unknowingly to people who beat me and put me in handcuffs, tied up my legs, and delivered me to Al-Qaeda. I didn't have to go. Nobody put the gun to my head, said, go off to Syria and try to report. I did do it myself.
Did it make you think that journalism was a silly enterprise because you'd been so duped?
Because nothing is worth the kind of suffering that they put you through. And what kind of illumination was I going to bring to the story? And how many people were going to read my New Republic articles? You know, I continue to think this. A human life is much more important than putting your head in front of a gun and allowing other people to pull the trigger. So many young men don't realize that that's what they're doing when they set off into the Islamic State or into any area that's under the control of the rebels right now. I mean,
what sense did you get of the people who were your captors? I mean, they gave you glimpses of.
Not only glimpses, I lived with these guys for 2 years. I mean, I know them well. I'm still in touch with them. Their families, moms, dads, wives, they have ambition. Some of them are talented. Some of them are backwards. Some of them could have gone on and led happy lives but decided instead for the jihad.
How did it change from, you know, smacking you head against the wall to gradually having actual relationships with these people?
It wasn't anything I did, I believe. It was the fact that they at some point decided that they were going to deal me and not kill me. And so they wanted to basically rehabilitate me, bring me out from the worst and most horriblest conditions into something that was like livable and survivable. But it wasn't because I was charming or spoke Arabic or you know, established a rapport. It wasn't that. It was a commander made a decision. And if he had made a decision, kill him or keep him until he starves to death, I would have starved to death or died with a bullet in my head.
Did they believe at any point that you could be useful as a like spokesperson?
Yeah. I mean, they often told me, yes, as soon as you get back, you'll speak on our behalf to the media. And I said, of course I will. Just let me go. Let me go and I'll say whatever you like. You know, I was interested in convincing them, as John Cantley is, by the way, now. He's the English ISIS hostage, acting as a spokesman and, you know, propagating their point of view. You do this because you're trying to live. The alternative is death.
Knowing as you do the conditions in Syria right now and the people who are living under those conditions, how hard is it to talk about your own torture?
Oh, my torture is nothing compared to what they're living through. It's totally inconsequential. I survived. I'm happy. My future is a million times brighter. A lot of people, you know, they go through the same thing. They get out and they have continuing misery, whereas I have beautiful New York City I can run around in. I have my whole life in front of me.
When you say go through what you went through, what are you talking about?
I mean, they confined me in a narrow space for a long period of time and inflicted physical and mental suffering on me. But it was not so much to kill me. It wasn't so much to injure me in a permanent way. I'm fine. So a lot of people are going through a lot. A lot of people come out with injuries that that you can't recover from. And a lot of people are being killed.
What does torture erase from you in the moment that it's going on?
What does it erase? I mean, that's a good question. I guess you just become a body. You're just this, you know, you're screaming from a place within that you never knew it existed. And so the only thing you're thinking about is how can I make it stop? You know, and you have no control and it's children doing this to you. You know, during the torture, I thought they were killing me. I was I couldn't see because they had me in a blindfold. So I thought they're killing me. I'm dying this way. You know, afterwards, they took me out of the torture room and they go, tomorrow it's going to be worse. And it was. So I didn't want to live anymore. I mean, they took away my will to live.
What was freedom like? The first moment.
Joyous.
The first
moment. Delightful. It continues to be delightful.
What, just describe the moment you realized that it was over.
I cried. I cried. I mean, it wasn't all of us. There were a few moments that were weeping, and then I woke up again and I was free. And I thought they're going to take me back. So it took me a while to like realize I was safe. Maybe 24 or 48 hours, even when I got home to America after like maybe 3 or 4 days, I was still in a daze. I'm like, I was having dreams. I would wake up in the Islamic State with the guys all around me, and I didn't think it was real, but it has been, and it's been gorgeous, you know? I mean, I thank everybody that has met me and made my life better since I got out.
Physically, what changed when you realized that you were free, and how did you know that it was over?
They delivered me to a pair of UN trucks, and I got into a like a big UN SUV that was painted white on the outside, guys with blue helmets on the inside, and there's Filipinos, and they were clearly not Al-Qaeda. I hadn't seen anyone really but Al-Qaeda people for 2 years. I'm like, you guys aren't the same dudes that I've been dealing with. I must be UN. Maybe I'm free. And then I really lost it.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the way it happened.
And your reunion with your family?
When I first saw my cousins in New York, you know, they took me off the airplane. We had a connection in New York, and I was delighted and joyous and, like, smiling. And an instant later, I was in tears. Then more joy, and then weeping and joy and weeping. It was, you know, it was like that for weeks, really, after I got home. I had so much emotions, and I had kept everything, like, under control for 2 years. And suddenly, I could feel the joy and the regret and the sadness and it just pent up emotions I expressed and heard music. It just destroyed me listening to songs.
How do you keep from hating all of the people in Syria?
When I was there, I promised myself that I would never forgive them, not for what they did to me, but for what they were doing to my fellow prisoners who were getting it worse. I said, I'll never. I made this promise to myself. And since then, I've become friends with these people on Facebook, and I chat with them. And I think the only way to peace is to forgive them, you know, let them drop their weapons. Okay, that's a precondition. But after they drop their weapons, there's so many of them, we can't kill them all. And we got to make peace if we want a future for them and for us. We got to live with these guys. We got to make peace. So I think we got to forgive and forget.
What do you hope this movie does to individuals in the United States who see it and who have had enough of Syria and misery and have had enough of the Middle East?
I hope they pressure the U.S. government to engage in a constructive way on all sides of this conflict. At the moment, we refuse to talk to Party A, Party B, and Party C because we say you people are so beyond the bounds of our moral framework that we find you repulsive in a moral sense. We won't talk to you. That puts us out of the game. It puts us on the sidelines. We have no skin in the game. We have no influence. We have no capacity to affect anything. And we've really washed our hands of the whole thing. And meanwhile, the slaughter is continuing. And we're giving the rebels guns and weapons that we would never tolerate on our streets. We're really, at the moment, we are very, counterproductive and dangerous influence in the conflict. And I think this is, it's a bad thing. So I hope the audiences will say, gee, we should change our policy.
People say again and again, there's nothing to be done in Syria.
That's not true.
It's just beyond.
Yeah, we should let them kill one another until the end of time. Now, of course, look, the huge issue is that we are supplying, and many countries in the Gulf are giving very powerful, sophisticated weaponry to people that they know nothing about. And by the way, we're giving money to other people we also know nothing about. Groups that allegedly protect the civilians, like these white helmets. Now, they do a lot of beautiful work. At the same time, if you type in Jabhat al-Nusra, white helmets, into Google, you see them executing people. You see them piling the corpses of people they have accused of supporting Bashar al-Assad into the back of pickup trucks. Where are you taking these people, they say? Oh, to the trash. These people, Assad supporters. These are the white helmets that we're giving millions and millions of dollars to. Now, and they're lionized in this movie and that movie, and all the journalists think they're great. I think that we need to know who these people are before we give them millions of dollars. What kind of law are they supporting and enforcing on the ground? We don't know. We give them cash. Off you go. Good luck. This is very dangerous for the country.
So from your perspective, people who claim that they're in fact fighting for right are sustaining a conflict that kills people, including the white helmets, including the government. They're all complicit.
Listen, certainly all sides believe that they are on the moral side and they're doing the righteous thing, and they're furthering justice by killing people. And I think they are furthering injustice, and killing is not the solution. Guns are not the solution. These people have lived with one another for generations and gotten along, and they can do it tomorrow if only we get the guns out of their hands. My belief is that it's the guns and the weapons are a terrible, terrible, tragic thing that we're inflicting on this country. We should stop it right away.
The world is a cynical place. What would it mean to you if the consequence of this film and you speaking out were to be that people conclude, wow, they really got to him. He's not making any sense. He's become naive now and an idealist.
Yeah, certainly people will say, draw many conclusions about me, and I welcome whatever conclusions they wish to draw. I can't impede them. I can only encourage them to read what I write and to listen to what I'm saying. I mean, I think that anyone who examines the situation closely and is in touch with all parties in the conflict and follows every day, developments on the ground will come to the conclusions I've come to. And they won't think I'm naive or stupid or reactionary or anything. They'll just go, look, peace now and truth and reconciliation later. It's very important, this truth and reconciliation. But we can't have it until the parties stop murdering one another. Right now, that's what they're doing. Every day, killing, killing, killing. And I mean, every time we send a gun or a bullet their way, we postpone the process of truth and reconciliation, to which, of course, it will eventually happen, but we're delaying it by being so obtuse.
when you got involved in this, you believed very much in the significance and importance of journalism and that the impact that it could have on your life. Do you believe more or less in the power and importance of journalism today?
There are people doing beautiful journalism, and I believe more, if anything. I'm totally supportive of the heroic efforts of many journalists, but at the same time, they exaggerate their importance. They go, oh, I must go and put my head in the news because it's going to be a great story. No, it's not worth it. It's not worth coming to the brink of death or taking these terrible risks. For what? I mean, there are many people writing now who take very few risks. For instance, you know, the woman who covers ISIS for the New York Times, a woman named Rukmini Kalamaki, she writes the most beautiful stories. I don't think she's like, you know, putting herself in harm's way. She does it in a discreet, responsible, intelligent, mature way, and she brings the deep news to us. So I think that journalism is important. It's just we should do it in a more intelligent way than I myself did it.
10, 20 years from now, how will you look back on this experience? What do you think you will tell the people who you love the most and are closest to you?
I mean, don't do this to your family. Don't subject your family to your disappearance. For what? Look, the coming very close to death for me, it taught me a lot about life. Like I am so much more appreciative and cognizant of the gifts and privileges that I have. But you know, you cannot go and submit yourself to Al-Qaeda in order to learn about life. Like War and Peace, a great novel by Tolstoy will teach a lot about life too. You know, there are other ways to do it. There's other ways to do it, but I believe very much in the enterprise of the journalists. They're doing a wonderful job, many of them. And the ones that aren't, it's not because they're bad, they're stupid. It's just because maybe they need to take a little more time.
If in the future a child of yours decides, based on knowing about your life, to take similar risks, will you feel that you have failed to bring the kind of peace that you had really hope to do?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, I was naive and I was, there are many ways to be adventurous. You can be adventurous in a library, read an incredible diversity of books. You can be adventurous in, you know, in your daily life in a million different ways. And you don't need to do it by going and submitting yourself to Al-Qaeda warriors.
But it would be your vision that there'd be no need to ever do this in the future, that it wouldn't occur to people to do something like this because the world would have changed.
I mean, I hope for peace in the future. Yeah, I hope. But I assume that parties will always be interested in having battles and killing one another. And it's important that we know about this. But you know, this conflict in Syria, the combatants themselves are producing the most incredible footage of their acts. Every day on YouTube, there turns up an enormous volume of evidence of what is happening on the ground today. And the issue is we don't have journalists that know the context, the language, the culture from which these videos arise, and so they don't register.
But to advocate for peace sincerely does not require a special ticket to go to the ground to understand anything. You say the best journalists that are writing today are not putting themselves in danger and are getting the message across.
Hold on. I'm not sure they're advocating for peace, these people. The best journalists are trying to understand the psychology, for instance, of an Islamic State. What is it that holds these people under control? What is it that deepens their commitment to the Islamic State? Why is it that they're willing to commit these atrocities in the name of their government and their God? I mean, the best reporters are helping us answer these questions. Why are they throwing gay people from the towers? Why are they destroying the ancient cities? They've never done this before. What strange configuration of factors has contributed to these incredible crimes that are occurring? Well, the best journalists are helping us, but they're not helping us understand this, but they're not necessarily forwarding the cause of peace, but that's not their job.
Do you feel you have that understanding that you sought out?
I'm always looking for more, but I feel that, I understand that because I'm like watching these videos. I'm talking to the people every day on all sides of this conflict. And my experience in Syria allowed me to generate these contacts. That's why I understand. And, you know, it's because the continuing interest that I have in the situation, it's not because like 2 years ago I was in jail for 2 years. I mean, that's some of it, but it's the continuing commitment to understanding and talking to everybody.
Do you think you'll ever be able to say goodbye to Syria in your life?
I hope not. I won't submit myself to danger again. But no, it's a beautiful country, and I want it to come back and prosper. And I want all the Syrians I know to have happy lives in their own country. You know, I know a lot of refugees in Germany. Well, I think they're kind of sick in Germany by now, although that's a wonderful country too. They really want to go home. So I want the place to be, once again, a civilized, safe society that, you know, basically recognizes and accepts and tolerates all the great tapestry of religions that exist there.
Theo Padnos is an American journalist and a former Syrian hostage. Thank you so much, Theo.
Thank you for having me.